So what are the odds that you can find a use for some of the flotsam and jetsam, the junk and debris, the rubbish and the trash, the detritus and the garbage, the stuff of your everyday life? Well, stay tuned for the next Mind's Eye Radio and receive the collective wisdom of our writers who will croon you some tunes and spin the dross of your lives to some golden ends. That's Mind's Eye Radio. It's radio within reach. Out of stuff that had accumulated there. Perhaps some people have a place for everything and everything in its place, as tidy people advise. But today's Mind's Eye Audio Collective, who are among the great majority who find themselves harboring such strange items, have found a use for them in today's show, The Flotsam and Jetsam, or The Junk Drawer of Life. Writers frequently soothe themselves that even the most mundane of jobs, and many writers have held these soul killers to support their writing habits, are finally going to work out to have been good material. These are the ones you see furtively scribbling on the tablecloths in restaurants. But as Kathy Miner has discovered, there is a more efficient way of saving these scraps for later use.
Whether they admit it or not, just about every writer has some way of collecting little bits of material that might be worth expanding on someday. To a writer, everything is fair game. A fragment of conversation overheard in an elevator, the precise way the sun shimmers off the hairs on a sunflower leaf, just how those denim jeans droop beneath the rear end of the teenager who's standing at the front of the bus, you simply never know when you might want that detail back. Probably some people have such fabulous memories that they can just store it away and access it again when they need it, but the rest of us have to scribble it down on any available scrap and then, like a squirrel, stash it somewhere for future use. Some writers, and undoubtedly some squirrels, are more systematic than others. I once heard Anne Lamott describe her personal technique, and I figured anyone who can write a book as good as Bird by Bird, which is not about birds, by the way, is worth listening to. She never goes anywhere without a 3x5 card folded in half and sharply creased in her pants pocket, and a tiny stub of a pencil. Why the card? Why the folding? And why the stub? Because she doesn't want anything to look bulky, she said. It's relevant here to note that Anne Lamott stands about 5'0" tall and might weigh 90 pounds if she's just been dunked in a washtub fully clothed. The biggest thing about her is her hair. So a little assignment-sized spiral notebook, which most of us might be able to conceal on our persons, would loom large on hers. Anyway, every time she notices some detail that she wants to save, she whips out the card and the pencil and writes it down. She now has several shoeboxes full of the unfolded cards, each of them a potential resource. If she gets hit by a bus tomorrow, she said, her legacy to her son, her net worth, will be those boxes. The flotsam and jetsam of her thought process, hundreds of snippets that struck her as important at the time. Isn't that the definition of odds and ends? I was impressed by the index card system and actually carried it off for most of a year. So now I have 2/3 of a box full of writing ideas. I thought, for this essay, that I would reach in and pick out at least one, absolutely at random, and see what happens, where that leads. First pick, a card dated 13 March, 1997. I'm strong in terms of what I can bear and survive, but not the least bit tough in terms of what I show. A space, and then, strong yet soft? Sounds like toilet paper. I can do what needs to be done, almost no matter what it is. I just don't make it look easy, because often it isn't. Last week, my cat died. She was 14 years old, and we'd had her since she was so little you could hold her in one cupped hand. She'd been in what looked like perfect health, and then one afternoon I came home and she lay terribly still on the living room floor, the catnip mouse, her favorite toy, right behind her. It was as if she'd been playing with it and had been stricken in mid-leap, falling to the carpet as a tree falls to the earth when severed from its roots by a gust of wind or a man with a chainsaw. Which way had death appeared to her? Does it matter? My husband was out of town until the next day. Whatever had to be done, I was going to have to do it. I rose to the occasion, finding a fleecy pink towel to wrap her in, and then a box in which to carry her on the final trip to the vet, who would send her body out for cremation. I won't pretend that it was easy. Why should I? It wasn't. I loved that cat. She was warm and soft and affectionate, and she was there every day for 14 years. Her life spanned the time between my son's adolescence and their independent adulthood. We got her the year I turned 40. You do the math. Now, when I went to lift her from the floor, the warmth that remained in her body surprised me. I wasn't ready for that. I had to set her back down gently and wait a little while. Had to compose myself and make absolutely sure she wasn't going to wake up. My point here is that I could and did take care of things, but I refused to pretend that I did it without a wrinkle. Smooth as for Teflon, and who wants to be that? I cried some, and whimpered some, and talked to her as if she could still hear me. I hope it happened quickly, Marbles, I whispered. I'm sorry I wasn't here to help, however I could. To my way of thinking, if I could have gotten through those minutes and hours, showing nothing but briskness and practicality, if I could have driven dry-eyed across town and calmly handed her body to the veterinarian, it would have been trivializing what she had meant to me. I'm not about to go into a tailspin and stay there forever, but I'm not going to pretend it's just business as usual either. I don't necessarily admire people who can get through difficult things with nary a quaver. I think there's a greater honesty in showing the quavers than straightening one's shoulders or accepting the offered hand and moving on. Allowing yourself to descend into the grief or confusion or anger that you feel, secure in the knowledge that after an hour or a day or a year, you will climb out, deeper and stronger, but not necessarily tougher than you were when you began. Showing that this is hard or sad or painful, but that it can be done. One of my favorite nuggets of wisdom in the book The Little Prince by Saint-Exupéry comes in the scene at the well. The little prince and his companion have been traveling in the desert, and the prince is in desperate need of a drink of water. They come upon a well. At considerable effort, Saint-Exupéry draws a bucket of water for his young friend, and he drank. This water was indeed a different thing from ordinary nourishment. Its sweetness was born of the walk under the stars, the song of the pulley, the effort of my arms. It was good for the heart, like a present. L'effort de mes bras, the effort of my arms. The work, the hard work of pulling the heavy bucket up the long, dark shaft of the well, that was part of the gift. If it had been, or looked, easy, it would have diminished the value of the giving. If we make life look easy, we lessen its value as well. Golly, all that from a random note that ends with the phrase toilet paper. I won't even tell you what was on card number 2. Trying to resist squeezing the Charmin, this is Kathy Miner for Mind's Eye Radio.
It's not common for us to imagine ourselves made up of nothing but odds and ends of our ancestors and those we have encountered. But Esther Cameron acknowledges her debts in One Construct to Another.
This is part of a poem by Grace Ellery Channing, which I retrieved from the 1901 or 1902 volume of the Atlantic Monthly. Inheritance. Lo, what am I? A patch of things, mere odds and ends of lives flung by, from age-long rag-bag gatherings pieced up by fate full thriftily. Somebody's worn-out will and wit, somebody's habits and his hair, discarded conscience, faith once fair, ere time the moth had eaten it. My great-grandfather's chin and nose, the eyes my great-grandmother wore, and hands from some remote, who knows, perchance prehensile ancestor. Somebody's style, somebody's gait, another body's wrist and waist, with this one's temper, that one's trait, one's tastes, another's lack of taste. Out of the ashes of their fires, out of the fashion of their bone, they fashioned me, my mighty sires. And shall I call my soul my own? That was, again, Grace Ellery Channing. I was wondering what to bring to this gathering of poems on odds and ends, when I happened across the poem Inheritance by Grace Ellery Channing, and I realized that I myself had written almost the same poem in 1996, perhaps 100 years after Channing's poem was written. One construct to another. How it may be with you, I do not know. But in the mirror, I don't often see myself alone. I see an endless flow of thoughts and traits, assembling randomly like strangers at a bus stop, who elsewhere are found again in other combinations. The color of my eyes and curl of hair, the love of words and patterns, and the impatience that would not let me teach, are all on loan, our grave goods furbished up for one more use. And when I speak, I catch, as overtone, the echo of some long-estranged friend's voice, who left some gesture, phrase, or trick of seeing behind in the apartment of my being. This is Esther Cameron from Mind's Eye Radio. There seem to be two basic styles of thinking. One of them works in categories and orderly hierarchies, pigeonholes like Aristotle's system, and it tries to arrange things a priori in some sort of preordained scheme. The other works with bits and pieces. It takes the facts, it takes the little givens that life gives us, and it shuffles them around until by some strange chemistry they coalesce into a form. And this seems to be the way evolution works, too. Some people may have read a book by John Livingston Lowe called The Road to Xanadu, which describes how Coleridge wrote The Ancient Mariner and Kubla Khan. It seems that these works, which have a tremendous stylistic integrity and oneness, each for itself, came together out of all sorts of bits and pieces from Coleridge's reading, especially of travel books, reports of travel to places that were new to Europeans at that time. Just little details picked out, and somehow in his mind they coalesced to form these incredible visionary landscapes, like nothing that no one has ever seen. So, as said, evolution may perhaps work that way also, not only by natural selection, but also by some strange process of coalescence and self-organization, to which there is a real analogy in the poet's unconscious process. Just a few scraps of thought on odds and ends from Esther Cameron.
Poets are useful in an odd sort of way. They can spin a fancy rhythm or compose a pleasing rhyme to entertain a patron or the masses. But when we go looking for folks who actually know things, we probably look elsewhere. Not so fast, says Lynn Patrick Smith.
Two poets compete as a team on a quiz show. The TV producers thought we would be entertaining, but that we would not win the big money. After all, how much trivia would a couple of poets be willing to leave cluttered inside their brains when the space was needed for contemplating serious matters? It was obvious they had not read any of either Richard's or my poetry. We started off strong. Richard sang us through famous opera composers, and I reeled in a complete list of Fellini films. We did have a slight disagreement on famous quotes, but decided to go with Richard's choice, and it was indeed Robert Graves who said, "To be a poet is a condition rather than a profession." These were not categories to hold the interest of the television audience. It was just for dramatic effect. The producers wanted us to get some answers correct, but not too many, because demographics show poets are not the kind of contestants most people would root for, not even if they are poets from the Midwest. They were hoping we would stumble when the categories became more suited to the average viewer, like, say, sports. Who missed the last-second field goal that cost Buffalo the 1991 Super Bowl? Richard nailed this one, quickly replying, "That would be Scott Norwood." I kicked in that this event later became an integral part of the plot for the independent film Buffalo 66, thinking that we would get extra points for added information. We did not. In fact, this only seemed to annoy the host, who I'm sure disliked independent films because so many of them made you think, and that was not his idea of entertainment. They next tried to stump us with a trick question, which fortunately I knew the answer to. Ty Cobb's number was not retired, not for the obvious reason that everyone despised him, but simply the fact that he played before the introduction of numbered uniforms. Still hoping to trip us up, we sank into the dregs of pop culture. 1980s sitcoms, summer box office hits, fashion trends of the 70s. We were slowing down, but we still came up with the names of all the barflies on Cheers, knew that Jurassic Park scared moviegoers in the summer of 1993, and we were certain that leisure suits and platform shoes were as popular as disco dancing and green shag carpeting. The producers were getting nervous. The poets were getting close to the grand prize. Something had to be done. So they skipped right over daytime soap operas and went straight for the jugular, televised professional wrestling, which no self-respecting poet would know anything about, and I assure you, Richard and I did not. This is Lynn Patrick Smith for Mind's Eye Radio.
Ex-philosopher and reluctant talker John Morgan gifts us with some of his down-to-earth wisdom from his collection of odds and ends.
When I was younger, one of the most frequent questions people asked me was, "Why are you so quiet?" I would look at them indulgently and reply, "Language is not my native tongue." That usually shut them up, unless they got the joke. In that case, we would wind up having a wide-ranging conversation. But I was still a better listener than a talker. The truth is, I was quiet because I was thinking. In those days, I would rather think than talk. Of course, I realized that once I had gotten everything thought out, I would have to talk about it, or there would have been no use thinking about it. And that day eventually came. So I began to practice talking. Before long, I could not only understand English, I could speak it as well as you. Well, almost. But then a strange thing happened. Now the most frequent thing people said to me was, "You know, you think too much." I would reply to them, "I don't think so. Think about it." But I considered it a compliment that people thought I thought too much. That showed that I was doing something right. In a culture that is suspicious of thought and prefers mindless action as a way of life, I was pleased that I had managed to keep thought alive. It might be imagined that, being born with a thoughtful nature, I might have become a philosopher. Well, I am a philosopher. but I am a philosopher who has rejected philosophy. I studied philosophy just long enough to realize that it is a bottomless can of worms, or a slippery slope to a somatic snake pit that offers no hope of ever understanding reality. So I became a humorous writer with a philosophical bent. That is my only nod to philosophy, except that I couldn't stop thinking. When I wasn't writing humorous poems in my notebook, I was jotting random thoughts. Some of these have the nature of epigrams, but for now they are just odds and ends of thoughts. So, on the subject of odds and ends, I have selected a baker's dozen of them, which I think have some substance, with the hope that they are not too funkadelic. Consider these odds and ends, and here let me bend your ear, in case you give a damn, with the odd epigram. Some people go to the desert to find themselves. Some people find themselves in the desert and wonder how they got there. If it is true that opposites attract, if a bonehead married an airhead, they should be a perfect match. Achieving world peace will not be difficult. All we have to do is rise to the ethical level of prairie dogs. History shows that people work hard to prevent reality from coming true. Okay, here's a little one in verse. Allah, Yahweh, and God must think their children odd, must hang their head in shame for what is done in their name. Continuing. Equality has gotten so bad that even people who are stereotypes are complaining about being stereotyped. The wisdom of the people will triumph over the ignorance of the masses. And one more. The admonition, thou shalt not kill, implies the corollary, thou shalt not provoke others to kill you. And to wrap up this grab bag on a lighter note, the National Association for the Advancement of Apathy, NAAA, or NAAA, will hold a rally next Saturday at noon on the square. Suggested placards, we don't care, who cares, whatever, mock snicks, say the status quo. The NAAA is planning to merge with the National Association of Procrastinators, NAP, so that they can combine their effectiveness. Merger plans have been in the works for 20 years. And last but not least, remember, never go to a psychiatrist who graduated from Wasamata U. This is John Morgan for Mind's Eye Radio.
Henry James encouraged writers to be those upon whom nothing is lost. And so, Norma Gay Pruitt tries her best by catching potentially useful material in a swollen file folder called Odds and Ends.
Hunter S. Thompson shuffled off that mortal inner spring mattress. Too bad. Last of the gonzo journalists. He left a short poem, almost a haiku. Walk tall, kick ass, learn to speak Arabic, love music, and never forget that you come from a long line of truth seekers, lovers, and warriors. It reminds me of a poem by William Carlos Williams that purports to be a note he left behind for his wife to find one morning. This is just to say that I have eaten the plums that you were probably planning to eat for breakfast. Forgive me, they were so sweet and so cold. I have always loved and hated that poem. Loved it because it is so gem-like in its image of the plums. Hated it because it is so posed and stagey of him, and I would swear it isn't as spontaneous as it is meant to seem. A tribute to my strong feelings about it is attested to my having written a parody of it once. Here are a few of my own bon mots. Life is short, and so am I. Who has ever heard of a promising old poet? All we need sometimes is a neighbor close enough to bless us when we sneeze. Well, let's see here. Here are some inspirations from the greats. Facts and truth really don't have much to do with each other. That's from William Faulkner. And one of my favorites. Everywhere I go, I'm asked if I think universities stifle writers. My opinion is that they don't stifle enough of them. Flannery O'Connor. And then, the grossest thing about our gross national product today is our language. It is suffering from inflation. That's from some anonymous Time magazine writer. And here's one. You campaign in poetry. You govern in prose. Mario Cuomo. And I think, as well-nourished as many of us are today, we suffer greatly from irony deficiency. Oh, I said that. The great poet William Stafford gives this useful advice to those struggling with so-called writer's block. Lower your expectations. Maybe I lowered my expectations a little too far, since there are a bunch of my own titles here I never wrote anything under. Fugue in Blue Minor. Things I Thought I Told You. You Couldn't Have Known. Bits of String Too Short to Use. That Lonesome Valley. And What Do I Care? I'm Not Her. Some of my favorite titles by other people. My Father Moved Through Dooms of Love, E.E. Cummings. The Ballad of the Sad Cafe, Carson McCullers. And Mr. Daumier Smith's Blue Period and A Perfect Day for Banana Fish, both by J.D. Salinger. Here's my least favorite title, Untitled. Come on, get over yourself. This is Norma Gay Pruitt, truth seeker, lover, and warrior, walking as tall as I can for Mind's Eye Radio.
So what are the odds that you can find a use for some of the flotsam and jetsam of your life? Stay tuned for the second half of the show today and receive the collective wisdom of Mind's Eye writers who will croon you some tunes, spin the dross of their lives to some golden ends, and offer a hint or two about how to extricate yourself from a European misadventure. Fran Rahl never intended to have as large an adventure as she did on her vacation.
We will start with the firm rumor that Prince Charles and Camilla Parker Bowles are to be married finally on April the 8th, which is my birthday, an auspicious date indeed. From the Daily News, a new definition of coffee, the person who is coughed upon. One of my most odd adventures was being locked into two European toilets in the summer of 1970. At a rest stop in a scenic area, a lake in the Austrian Alps, my daughter and I found we were unable to exit a stall because we didn't have the right change. Why do it that way? If you need to spend a penny, as the English call it, one pays to enter. There was no coin changer attached to an inside wall. I forget if she went under the door to find her father or if we waited until he missed us and came looking. The next time I was alone, and it had some scary undertones. At a big French campground, I wandered away from our party and happened to go into a pit toilet. These enclosures were built in a row out of thick, unfinished planks, although the seat was finished okay. Upon arising, I found that some kid, I hope, had fastened the door from the outside, which also had hook and eye fasteners to keep out animals when they were closed up for the winter. I found out that the knocking noise was really swallowed up by the wood, plus it hurt my knuckles. So I stood up on the edge of the seat and prepared to yell out the narrow opening at the top of the door. I knew it would be a long time before the family got hungry and started looking for me. It would have probably worked okay to yell, "Help!" But for some reason I found myself remembering some French child's story, so I started yelling, "Au secours!" at intervals, hoping I'd be understood or heard. Suddenly, without any notice, a big man opened the door and I nearly fell into his arms. I knew enough French to say, "Merci, monsieur, thank you very much." But he walked off without saying anything, leaving me standing at the door calling, "Merci beaucoup." Our other experience in the same campground was exactly the opposite. Quite a few spoke very good English, which was nice, as our French was so limited. In a primitive-type cow pasture campground, my sister came back to camp very indignant. Some man ran right up to me and shouted, "Douche, douche," and ran off. This was a puzzle for some minutes until it dawned on me. "He means there's hot water in the shower. Quick, get some towels and soap, everyone." Afterwards, clean and shining, we went to the trailer and knocked. The man had gone to work, but we loaded his wife with thanks, even if she didn't know exactly what the whole thing was about, and we left them with some Kennedy half dollars, which someone had told my sister were good for tips. Really, the wife knew he'd helped us, her husband had helped us. As you can go a long ways with wet hair, pointing to a man and the wedding ring and saying, "Merci, douche." This is Fran Rawl, still trying to get out for Mind's Eye Radio.
Poet Josephine Zell knows that that which is rent asunder may never again be made whole, but that doesn't mean that we don't long for that outcome all the same.
Bits and pieces. That's what became of the blue jasper Wedgwood bow my best friend gave me on my 21st birthday. I put it in my dresser drawer because it was so precious. but one day the old drawer tipped as I opened it and the bowl fell out. It broke in pieces on the floor. I went to the china shop and bought another one. We lived in Wedgwood country, near the pottery kilns of Arnold Bennett's Five Towns. Now that bowl is in my china cabinet. In World War II, we saved every bit and piece of silver paper, chocolate wrappers, especially from Easter eggs, hollow but quite large. You formed a little ball, and when it grew too big for your hand, you started another. All the silver paper went to the munitions factory, along with every gate and iron railing taken from schools, churches, and private homes, except at Buckingham Palace and such royal residences. Very much discouraged were bits and pieces of furtive news. Careless talk cost lives appeared on the walls of bus shelters, railway stations, and in the public street. That bald head on the poster peeked at you, its long nose on your side of the wall. Nosy Parker was everywhere, forcing parents to explain to little children that conversations could be overheard, which wasn't good in wartime. At 6 years old, I didn't get the full story, just bits and pieces. I hovered between suspicion and trust. Today we long for something whole and wholesome, to grasp it to our chests, to feel its solidness, something that will not disintegrate, collapse, nor melt in the runoff from the gutters of our houses, weaken their foundations, and leave us bereft of consolation. This is Josephine Zell of Mind's Eye Radio.
Garage and yard sales, flea markets and bazaars, all are fertile hunting grounds for bargains. But in all those bins of odds and ends are some other person's memorabilia. Such musings have inspired more than one poet, as witnessed in this poem by Judith Zuckerman.
Legacies. A sturdy silver soup ladle with an engraved curved handle fits into the palm of my hand. A locket with a crescent of diamond slivers and one ample gem in the center opens with a place for two black and white photographs, my mother and her brother as children, Grandma's engagement present from Grandpa. A copper urn with one black handle missing, once brimmed with steaming, pulverized coffee. Kafalutsa served in demitasse cups to Grandma and Grandpa's relatives. Staring out of an ornate picture frame, a young woman in a high-collared dress, soft long hair rolled and swirled around her beaming immigrant face. Grandma, before she was married. Judith Zuckerman, Mind's Eye Radio. Thank you.
Here, Yvonne Yonke is similarly affected.
Antique shop. Poking around, I find old silver, old beads, displayed against old brocade. Lifted out of history where once these pieces were common, bought then by someone with a generous heart or a frugal need, valued now for the wear, the patina, they will be set down in a place of casual honor. Inspired touch will fill the teapot with mimosa. Old beads will hang around a new brass lamp. Once they may have adorned a lovely woman with a throat as soft as wedding silk. The history of these artifacts lies fallow, to be conjured up by browsers, new owners, who will never guess the truth the old things know. This is Yvonne Yonke for Mind's Eye Radio.
Sometimes what we choose to throw away really deserves that fate. Yet Oscar Morelis has discovered that if there is a child involved, dispensing with the stuff is much easier than satisfying a child's omnivorous need to know.
We were standing in our 4x4-foot bathroom, watching the toilet flush, and my 3-year-old son Diego asked, "Where does the caca go?" And without thinking, and wanting to give a quick answer, like a good father, I say, "In the lake." And my son pauses, then stares towards the wall. I could almost see what he was thinking about, being in the lake near our house, and swimming, or at least moving around in the water, and finding himself dodging turds as if they were red-striped buoys, warning us of danger. And before he could finish that thought, I change my answer, and say, It goes in the garbage, in la basura." And then my son runs over and peeks into our garbage bag hidden underneath the kitchen sink and says, "No está aquí, it's not here." And I was about to say, "Son, it's not that simple." But it was too late for my words to catch up to his racing footsteps. This is Oscar Morelis for Mind's Eye Radio. Ding 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 ding
All endings probably seem odd to those on the receiving end of the leave-taking, but as writer Matt Felgus has discovered, some endings are odder than others.
"I thought we were supposed to stay together, but we were both hurting, both bewildered by the intensity of this connection between us, and the situation was getting too odd to be believed. In the happier times, we laughed about her seeming ability to send to me. I would get some message from her under the surface, followed by a phone call asking, 'Did you get that?' But now I was still getting hit when I wasn't even thinking of her, with communication about her emotions or thoughts. So here I was, trying to give her space, but she didn't seem to be respecting mine. It was nearly impossible to write, and was threatening to affect other areas. She was holding on to something deep within me, and I needed it back. Holding on despite a month of no contact, the kind of contact that would be considered normal, that is. I called her on the phone, said I needed to see her, or I would have to disconnect for good. She refused and told me not to force her to make a choice. "Do you want this to end?" I asked. "Yes," she said, "and I don't love you." That last part, I knew it wasn't true. A few days later, I had a dream that felt to be something more. She and I were sitting at a table, white, plastic, something you'd see in a food court at the mall, but with nothing else around us. She was asking me to promise to stay on my path no matter what and not run away. Her green eyes burned into me, as though she wasn't going to let me leave until I did. I promised, and woke up not understanding what that was all about, assuming it meant that she was taking back what she had said and didn't want this to end. I never called her at work and didn't understand why I would be doing so on that day, but something compelled me. She wasn't there, but the person who answered her phone casually asked if I knew she was taking a job 1,000 miles away. Guess it needed to be a stranger to tell me. I felt kicked, also confused, and not knowing what to do with the pain. I called her at home. "When are you leaving?" "It's none of your business." There was nothing more to be said. Sometimes paths are supposed to interlock, and you both see some of what's ahead, but you can't know how the journey is to take place. For a time, things may not make sense. They may contradict what you think you know, but it all becomes clear if you keep looking. Sometimes it hurts and you have to turn away. Sometimes you're staring at a mountain that's too overwhelming. Sometimes you're not ready, or you know what's supposed to be and choose to run. The path is the path. It doesn't care who's on it. It just is. And somehow, in the end, it all goes as it's supposed to. I watched our paths separate for good. I have kept my promise to remain on mine. A part of her remained within me and became something I used for strength to keep walking forward. It has taken time, but I've stopped looking behind me. Goodbye, my friend. It has been odd, but this is the end. This is Matt Felgus from Mind's Eye Radio. Thank you.
Singer-songwriter Paul Thompson sometimes lies awake recalling how he was sung to sleep.
Among the odds and ends I think of late at night, after I've gone to bed and before I fall asleep, I remember the wordless lullaby my mother would sing to me when I was a small child. Bye-lo, 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 bye. Even when I was a little older, in the second or third grade, if I fell and scraped my knee or suffered some disappointment, I would climb into my mother's lap, and she would rock and comfort me with that familiar song. Bye-lo, 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 bye-lo. That was many years ago, and my mother was long departed when I discovered at a church service that her lullaby was actually an old hymn tune, she having been raised in a minister's household. Now at 68, staring at the ceiling in the night, I still remember how her voice comforted and soothed my hurt until it magically went away, and I wish that I could hear that voice once more. In tribute to my mother, I've composed another lullaby, this one with words. I'd like to sing it to you now, to the accompaniment of my authentic period music software. Hit it, boys. Gently rocking, gently rocking, warm and snug within my arms. Gently rocking, gently rocking, safe from all that hurts or harms. Do not fret, my little baby, hear the wind caress the trees. Listen to its twilight singing, hear its sleepy melodies. Gently rocking, gently rocking, warm and snug within my arms. Gently rocking, gently rocking, safe from all that hurts or harms. Do not fret, my little baby, dreamland's just a nod away. Let the fairies fly you swiftly, let the fireflies light the way. My little baby, sleep will take you very soon to that land of dreaming flowers, golden flowers of the moon. Gently rocking, gently rocking, warm and snug within my arms. Gently rocking, gently rocking, safe from all that hurts or harms. This is Paul Thompson for Mind's Eye Radio, wishing you a good night, and don't let the bedbugs bite.
That's our show. Thanks for listening to Flotsam and Jetsam, or The Junk Drawer of Life, on Mind's Eye Radio. Perhaps we've helped you figure out how to use those trappings, the flotsam and jetsam of your own days and ways. The show was produced by Kelly Warren and co-produced by Gay Davidson-Zilski. Today's players are Esther Cameron, Matt Felgus, Kathy Miner, Oscar Morellis, John Morgan, Norma Gay Pruitt, Lynn Patrick Smith, Paul Thompson, Fran Rawl, Yvonne Yonke, Josephine Zell, and Judah Zuckerman. Original music by Barbara Chusett. You can hear Mind's Eye Radio at www.radioforall.net. That's the number 4. Or visit us on the web at www.mindseyeaudio.com. I'm Greg Williard. Thanks for listening. Till next time, best wishes from Mind's Eye Radio.